Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Please welcome Rick Wortsman, our interlocutor this morning. Rick, who you'll meet a little later in the program, is director of the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University, an Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and a columnist for Business Week. Previously, he spent two decades as a reporter and editor of the Wall Street at the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times. To introduce Sir Ken Robinson, please welcome Steve Mann, who is Senior Vice President and Regional Manager at Wells Fargo, part of the new Wells Fargo Wachovia family. Steve?
Thank you, Ted. I'm pleased to be here today to represent the Wachovia Foundation. In a short period of time in California, the Wachovia Foundation has made a meaningful impact. And now joining the Wells Fargo Foundation, we look forward to continued focus on and dedication to the communities in which we live. Our speaker today, Sir Ken Robinson, is an internationally recognized leader in the development of creativity, innovation, and human resources. He has worked with governments in Europe, Asia, and the United States, with international agencies, Fortune 500 companies, and some of the world's leading cultural organizations. In 1998, he led a National Commission on Creativity, Education, and the Economy for the UK government. The Robinson Report, All Our Futures, Creativity, Culture, and Education, was published to wide acclaim in 1999. He was the central figure in developing a strategy for creative and economic development as part of the peace process in Northern Ireland, working with the Ministries for Training, Education, Enterprise, and Culture. The resulting blueprint for change, Unlocking Creativity, was adopted by politicians of all parties and by business, education, and cultural leaders across the province. He was one of four international advisors to the Singapore government for its strategy to become the creative hub of Southeast Asia. Sir Ken Robinson speaks to audiences throughout the world on creative challenges facing business and education in the new global economies. Commenting on his latest book, Out of Our Minds, Learning to be Creative, John Cleese says, Ken Robinson writes brilliantly about the different ways in which creativity is undervalued and ignored in Western culture, and especially in our educational systems. For 12 years, he was professor of education at the University of Warwick in the UK and is now professor emeritus. He has been honored with the Athena Award of the Rhode Island School of Design for services to the arts and education, the Peabody Medal for contributions to the arts and culture in the United States, and the Benjamin Franklin Medal of Royal Society of Arts for outstanding contributions to cultural relations between the United Kingdom and the United States. In 2005, he was named as one of Time, Fortune, CNN's principal voice. In 2003, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II for his service to the arts. Please join me in giving Sir Ken a warm Los Angeles welcome.
Thank you very much. It's all true. If a bit exhausting, really, it's a bit of an ordeal to listen to your resume being read out, isn't it, first thing in the morning? And I mean first thing in the morning. Whose idea was this? A breakfast meeting. Stop it. Honestly, I was... You know, you're meant to start off these things saying what a pleasure it is to be here. I don't know. I think the jury's out, frankly, on this. I was at an event last night at the Hammer Museum, and I think we got to bed. Not all of us, it was me. Though it did go very well. So it was quite an evening. But all 300 of us went to bed at about 1 o'clock. And then I remembered I had to be up at 5 o'clock to do a radio interview. And I'd just gotten over that, and of course I woke up thinking about that and the fact I had to be here. So thank you for the invitation. That's any questions on any of that? No, seriously, it is a pleasure to be here. And not least of all because I live in Los Angeles. And I have a great affinity for the city. We moved out here in 2001. So if you do the math on this... If you do the math on this, my family and I have lived in America for 8 years. So our whole experience of America... if you get my drift. We also moved here on the 30th of June, 2001. So we moved here a couple of months before 9/11. So our entire experience of being resident in America has been post 9/11 under the previous administration. So I'm not making a party political point, but it's not been, I believe, the most buoyant period in American history. And like many people, I think, I felt a tremendous sense of exhilaration on the inauguration day, that this seemed to me to be genuinely trying to usher in a new spirit into America, a new sense of confidence and buoyancy. And I think that's really what's needed, not just in America, but internationally. And, you know, we do face times of the most extraordinary tumult and challenge. And I believe that the only way we're really going to contend with this is by thinking differently initially about ourselves. I say, we've been resident here now for 8 years. I also ought to say, by the way, that we moved here 3 days before Independence Day. We had no idea. I mean, get over it. What a performance. Anyway, people marching up and down with flags and bands, you know, celebrating the British have left. Do you know how that makes us feel? When we've just arrived. You know. But I've been very involved here in many ways in educational discussions and conversations. We were told, you know, when we came to America that Americans don't get irony. That's not true. I know that. But I'm just telling you. This is what people are saying about you behind your back. In Europe, you know, when we're at the airport leaving, people are saying, have a great time, but don't be ironic. You know, they won't get it. You know, don't be ironic. Of course, it's not true. And I travel all across America extensively. But I knew the minute I arrived that Americans got irony. When I came across that legislation, No Child Left Behind. Because whoever thought of that gets irony, you know, because that's a piece of legislation that's leaving millions of children behind. And I don't say this lightly. We put our own children into high school here. I believe that No Child Left Behind was very well intentioned. It had all party support. Its aims are honorable and well founded. The problem is it's based on a whole series of misconceptions about human ability, about what motivates people, children and students, about human talent, and about the economic realities of the 21st century. Apart from that, it's great. I'd say it's a slam dunk, honestly, apart from that. But apart from being a total conceptual mess. And I say that because there are similar acts of legislation in many different parts of the world. Everyone's trying to reform education. Now, I start with education for a particular reason, which is this, that this particular book, The Element, I feel very strongly about. I was asked recently, how long did it take you to write this book? And there are two answers. One of them is about 8 months of actual sitting down, sweating, you know, and ignoring calls from the publisher. The real answer, though, is about 40 years. I mean, most of my adult life, counting that from when I was 19, I don't want you to get misled on this, you know, I'm not trying to undercall myself here. I've been passionate about these issues most of my professional life and adult life. And what I'm passionate about is this. My perception is that most adults have no idea what their real talents are, what they're genuinely capable of achieving. In my experience, most people drastically underestimate their capabilities. I don't mean they know what they are, but they demean them. They don't know what they are. And most people, it seems to me, spend much of their lives in work that they don't especially cherish, doing something because they happen to be doing it. They may have, you know, through force of circumstances, end up doing something, bumping along, getting on, but with no deep sense of fulfillment from the work they do. Do you agree with me about this? And yet I meet people, too, who are passionate about what they do, people who couldn't imagine doing anything else, who believe that through the work they do or the way they live their lives, that they are deeply in touch with their authentic self, that this is really what they should be doing. And the book is about that, about what the difference is and what makes the difference. Why is it that some people find that and other people don't? And what are the implications of it for all of us? So the book has lots of stories in about people who have found what I call their element. But I also say in the book, it's not really about them, it's about everybody else. Because underpinning the book is a profound conviction that we all have deep natural talents. Some people have discovered them, but they're there for all of us to discover if we think differently about ourselves, and particularly if we manage our institutions differently. And there are three big arguments that underpin the book. One of them is that this is essential for personal fulfillment. It's, in a way, I believe it to be a human rights sort of issue, that unless people live lives that have meaning and purpose and feel tuned to themselves, they are, in a genuine sense, unaware of who they really are. The second reason is cultural. You know, Al Gore, some of you, I think, you told me just over breakfast, have seen the TED video. How many of you have seen that? So you can all go now. So, no, not really. No, seriously. There's a great conference called TED, and I gave a talk there about creativity and education, which has, by the way, been downloaded now 4 million times, which I found rather remarkable. And I was feeling good about that until my son, who's 24, showed me a video on YouTube, which is 90 seconds long, and it's of two kittens that seem to be having a conversation with each other. And that's been downloaded 17 million times. So, I'm, you know, get an angle, I feel. Do not get carried away with this. Anyway, Al Gore gave the talk that became the movie, that became the movement, Inconvenient Truth. He didn't invent the climate crisis. He didn't think of it first. He wasn't the first to point it out. Rachel Carson talked about this in the 60s. Benjamin Franklin was issuing warnings about this in the 18th century. We've known for a long time that industrialism threatened to put the world's natural climate at risk. This is not a new idea. We've just chosen to ignore it for generations, and now it's coming home. I believe it. But I also think there's another crisis, another climate crisis, a crisis not of natural resources, but of human resources. Now, it may be that you think, you know, honestly, I'm good. You know, I have one crisis. Thank you very much. I don't really need a second one. But I think the second one is as profound. You know, just while you're checking out your to-do list, it's as profound, and its origins are the same. Its origins lie in the same intellectual, cultural, and social movements that gave rise to the Industrial Revolution. It's predicated on a particular view of intelligence and ability, which I believe marginalizes many people and the better part of most people's capabilities. For all the great good that came from the Enlightenment, we've grown up with a schismatic view of the mind. And I think it's marginalized many people's talents. And I'll give you an example of this. You see, when I say the analogy is with the climate crisis in the natural world, I think it's an exact analogy. One is that it's costing us a huge amount of money to clear up the mess that we've created. In California, next year, I think 2010, according to the state's projections, spending on the correctional system in California will exceed spending on higher education. I mean, what is that as a conception? I mean, what kind of conception of humanity is it that leads us to believe that we have to invest more money clearing up dysfunction than cultivating genuine talent and purposefulness at the beginning of our lives? See, I don't get it. I do not believe that this is based on any sound conception of humanity. I don't believe there are that many bad people out there. I mean, there are people in bad circumstances, people who make bad choices, people who, out of despair or anger or some desperation, do bad things. But naturally bad? I don't think so. You know, I just don't think there are that many psychopaths around. Actually, you don't need that many psychopaths in Venice. I mean, one goes a long way, I find, don't you, really? Really, if you meet two psychopaths in a day, that's a bad day on the whole, isn't it, really? That's worth a journal entry, I feel. Dear diary, the day started badly. So I think there's a genuine crisis of human resources. There's another respect in which the analogy holds good, which is that this is a vast source of profit for many people. One of the reasons that the climate crisis in the natural world has been sustained so long is that so many people profited from it. You know, from minerals, from petroleum, from keeping it that way. There were vast commercial interests buttressing the problem that we knew we had to confront at some point. And truthfully, the only reason it's being tackled now is because the commercial equations have started to shift around. And there's a shift in consciousness which contributes to this. But equally, human dysfunction, human alienation, is a bounty for all kinds of corporations and institutions, not least the pharmaceutical companies, who make a great deal of cash, you know, from trying to mediate people's depressions. Not solve it. Nobody's trying to solve depression, except well-intentioned clinicians. But on the whole, drug companies aren't keen to solve it. Why would they do that? Now, by the way, I'm not talking here about clinical depression. I'm not talking about, you know, bipolar syndrome, you know, genuine clinical conditions. I'm talking about kind of existential, I can't be bothered. You know, I can't be dealing with this kind of depression. A lack of purpose and engagement. The other way in which the analogy holds good is this, that human resources, like natural resources, are often buried deep. You have to go looking for them. They're not lying around on the surface. I'll give you a couple of great examples of this. I am from Liverpool in Britain, hometown of the Beatles, I think, the popular music group. And I went to school in Liverpool, and across the city centre was another school, the Liverpool Institute. One of the pupils there was Paul McCartney. I didn't know him then, but the school is now a school for the performing arts, and I helped to get this school off the ground in the early days. I helped them with some of their assessment and standards issues. And I've been around the school a good bit, and I admire it hugely. They have a great guy called Mark Featherstone Whitty who's brought the school into being, and Paul McCartney is the patron. Anyway, a couple of years ago, they gave me an honorary degree. I do recommend this, by the way, as a trajectory. Because, you know, you slog away to get your first degree, and you reach a point where people just start handing them to you. It's fantastic, you know. Oh, you've got several degrees. Have another one. So I have a whole cupboard of, if you're interested, you know, I'm just... If you're looking for one, I have some on offer. No, but so I was given this. So I went back to Liverpool. I'm actually going back next weekend as well to get this at the school. And I was hanging out with Paul McCartney, or Paul, as I call him. So I asked him if he enjoyed music at school. You think he might have done, don't you? One of the premier musicians of our generation. He said he couldn't stand it, music at school. He said he went through the whole of his time at school and nobody thought he had any musical talent. Nobody swatted anything. One of the other pupils in the same music stream, a couple of years younger, was George Harrison, the lead guitarist of the said popular music group. And nobody spotted that he had any talent either. So this one music teacher in Liverpool, had half the Beatles in his class. And he missed it. John Cleese, that you heard mentioned in the introduction, I did some workshops with him a while ago. I shall keep dropping names, by the way. I hope that's okay. But John Cleese told me he went from kindergarten to Cambridge, and nobody ever thought he had a sense of humor. Elvis Presley was not allowed in the glee club at school in Tupelo, Mississippi. They said he would ruin their sound. Elvis, you know. We all know what great heights the glee club went on to. You know, once they managed to keep Elvis out. But I'll give you a much more recent example. I was in Danville in Northern California last week signing a book. Actually, I was signing lots of books. I didn't go all the way to Danville to sign this one book. You know, I mean, there were lots of people buying books. But this particular guy came up, and I was signing the book, and I said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm a fireman. I'm in the fire service here in Danville." I said, "That's fantastic. I mean, really, I mean, we owe these people so much." And I said, "That's fantastic." I said, "What made you do that?" He said, "I always wanted to do it." And he said, "But I was very interested in what you were saying about school, because," he said, "I never really did terribly well at school, and I had one teacher at school who made me feel terrible most of the time. He told me I was stupid because I didn't want to go to college and that I would never amount to anything." He said, "He told me that." He said, "And I really carried that." He said, "And then last year, I gave him CPR and saved his life after a road accident and his wife's life." He said, "I think he thinks more of me now." You see, this is really important. We're living in a culture where we've divided people into academic and non-academic, academic and vocational. There's a language here which is toxic, I think, in its assessment of human capacity. So people who don't feel engaged by or encouraged by a certain way of work end up thinking they're not terribly smart. And so the book is about that there is a profound crisis in human resources. We waste scandalous amounts of human talent needlessly, in the way we've wasted scandalous amounts of the Earth's natural resources needlessly. There's an ecology issue here to think about. And the third argument is this isn't just a whimsical, romantic argument about wouldn't it be nice if we all could do something we love to do. That is important. It's important for the health of our communities. It's also a sound economic principle. You know, this nation, all developed nations, actually all nations, all communities, depend upon sound and vibrant economic health, sound and vibrant economic conditions. Increasingly, I think it must be clear to people, I work with a lot of Fortune 500 companies, is that the old models have not worked for some time and are collapsing. And that the future will be won by those who really prize innovation, creativity, entrepreneurship, flexibility, and adaptability. We have global problems to confront. The old industrial model of linearity has been breaking down for a long time. We're in the final echoes of that model. And the future has to be based on a different conception of economic practices. It has to be certainly competitive, but more collaborative and more sustainable. And that will require a totally new way of thinking. And for individuals, the old linear models don't work anymore. You know, many people now have done all the right things and find themselves jobless and often penniless as the system has crashed around them. If we know anything about the future, it'll be that it will depend upon creativity, innovation, self-assurance, and the ability to create your own work and also to collaborate with other people in the process of doing it. And you see, this linearity thing really, I think, dates from this industrial mindset. The organizational culture of many companies, of public institutions, and particularly schools, is derived, I think, from the industrial ideology. I'll just give you a couple of quick examples. If you think of schools, for example, they are based totally on a Fordist model of production. You know, you start at the beginning and you pop through the far end and you're meant to be qualified and dumb. You know, I'm a boomer. Some of you are, I can tell, even at this time in the morning. And, you know, we were told a story, which was if you worked hard and did well and went to college, you would have a job for life. That's true, isn't it? The idea, you know, in the 70s and 80s, certainly in the 60s, that you would have a college degree but be unable to find work was outrageous. The only reason you would not have a job was if you didn't want one. And I didn't want one, as it turns out, so... but I knew as and when, you know, I could get a job, I'd just pop down and get one. These days, I mean, employers turned up at universities to recruit you, you know, in the bar, you know. These days, more and more kids with good college degrees are heading home again. You know, they're often called the boomerang generation, or they're staying on to do higher degrees because that's become essential. A first degree doesn't cut it anymore. You need a higher degree to be taken seriously. This breakdown in the currency of academic qualifications is one of the surest indications that the old model is bust. But we still insist on it. You know, the whole of public education is devoted to the idea of getting you to college. Now, two things follow from this. One is that some people don't need to go to college. They don't want to go to college. They want to go and do something else. Or they don't want to go to college now. You know, we get so many kids rattling around universities not knowing what they're doing for a couple of years. You know, it's much more purposeful for them very often to have done something else for a bit and then say, actually, I would like to go now because I know what I want to do. Some people want to get straight out in the world and get on with something. You know, and it's a perfectly honorable thing that they should want to do that. But I'll give you an example of just how I think we've become obsessed with it. I came across a policy paper a while ago here when I came to Los Angeles when I was based at the Getty. It was, I think, produced by LAUSD. And the title of it was, if I remember it properly, College Begins in Kindergarten. No, it doesn't. I mean, if we had more time, I could go into this, but we don't, so it doesn't. You know, kindergarten begins in kindergarten. There was a wonderful guy, there's a great place in Dublin called The Ark, which is a children's theatre company. And the director of that once said to me, he said, you know, a three-year-old is not half a six-year-old. A six-year-old is not half a 12-year-old. They're three. You know, give them a break. You know, but you know, in Los Angeles and New York and other places, people are competing for kindergarten places. Stop it. Competing. You know, kids being interviewed for kindergarten. At three, you know, producing resumes, presumably, and, you know... facing unimpressed selection panels, you know, thumbing through it. What, this is it? You've been around for 36 months and this is it? You know, you've achieved nothing. You know, spent the first 6 months breastfeeding, from what I can see. You see, it's a nonsense. It's born out of this linear assumption that life goes in a straight track. It doesn't. And this is just where I want to get to. When I talk about the element, because we're going to open this up for some conversation, I just want to kind of set a stage for it. When I talk about the element, I mean two things by this. You know, I had myself saying that people achieve their best when they do the thing they love, when they're in their element. So I thought, well, what is this? And why do some people love what they do and some don't? Well, it's at least two things. One is that if you're in your element, you're doing something for which you have a natural aptitude, a natural feel. And that's different for all of us. I'll give you one example. Have you heard of a guy called Bart Connor? Yes. Bart Connor's a fantastic guy. He lives in Norman, Oklahoma these days. When he was six, he found that he could walk on his hands as easily as he could walk on his feet. I don't know how he found this out. This is lost in the mysteries of time, but he could do it. And then he found he could walk up and down stairs on his hands as comfortably as on his feet. Well, you know, as he said, there wasn't a big future in this, but but he enjoyed it. And it made him socially popular. You know, he said, whenever the parties at the house or gatherings and the conversation lulled, you know, his dad would say, Bart, just do the hands thing there. Anyway, when he was eight... his mother, who'd been obviously taking this in, talked to the school gymnastics teacher and arranged for Bart to go down to the gymnastics center in his hometown of Morton, Illinois, Morton Grove. And he said, I have never forgotten that moment of walking into this extraordinary gymnasium. He said, to me, it was like a combination of Disneyland and Santa's Grotto. You know, there were ropes, trampolines, vaulting horses, wall bars. He said, it was just intoxicating. Well, you see, it's worth pausing on this, because we don't all have that feeling when we go into a gymnasium. You know, I don't. You know, if I go to gymnasium, I want to get intoxicated. You know, I don't. It's a totally different feeling, really. But he was overwhelmed by it. And he could just do this thing, you know. And he started going regularly every day. 10 years later, he walked onto the mat at the Montreal Olympics, representing the United States in the male gymnastics squad. He became the most decorated male gymnast in American history. He lives now in Norman, Oklahoma. He's married to Nadia Comaneci, you recall, who had the first perfect 10 in women's gymnastics. They have an extraordinary gymnastics school. And they are both leading lights here, Nadia, in the World Special Olympics movement. So between them, they've encouraged the physical fulfillment of tens of thousands of disabled athletes. Now, this is a great story about Bart. But there's another point here, which is that his mother, of course, could not have anticipated where this was going to go. She simply invested in what she saw in front of her. This is something special about this kid. This is something that helps define him. We should encourage this. I mean, I'm sure she didn't have a game plan, you know? I'd be surprised that she was thinking, hang on, Bart's six. He's doing this hands thing. There's this girl in Romania. You know, if we just move it around a bit, you never know. Of course not. Life is not linear like that. It's organic. What happens when you start to connect with your own talent is the environment you inhabit modulates around you. It becomes different. The world you're in is different. It's changed by your relationship with it. And it unfolds differently as a consequence. And we can't predict what that course will be. And actually, we can't predict it for anybody just now. So the final thing I just want to say about this is that the part of being in your element is having a capacity for something. It's not enough, though, to be good at something. Many people do things they're good at but don't enjoy. The real sweet spot here is if you love it too. Like Bart did, if you love this thing you're good at, you never really work again. If you look at the management charts of most organizations, I mean, think of your own organization, it contradicts that principle. They look like a wiring diagram, don't they? Most management charts, they look like a technical drawing. You have boxes, lines connecting it, arrows. It all looks like a wiring chart. And it all sort of enforces the idea that human organizations are like mechanisms. People talk about their functions in organizations. But human organizations are not at all like mechanisms. I mean, they have hierarchies, of course, and responsibilities and different roles, but a human organization is much more like an organism. What I mean is, it's a living thing. If all the people leave the building, there's no organization left in it. The organization is the people, their relationships, their motivations, their energy, their values, their aspirations, or lack of them. It's a living, breathing thing. And we've seen this actually played out over the past few months. A successful organism is one that reciprocates with its environment and helps to enrich the environment on which it depends. When that relationship is broken, the organism dies. And you see this happening time and again. I work a lot with Fortune 500 companies on these sorts of issues. The history of Fortune 500 companies is one of incessant mortality, of companies dying. And the reason they die is because they lose their relationship with the environment. They are victims of climate change in an absolutely fundamental way. So I think a better principle for human flourishing is not industrialism, it's agriculture. It's a more ancient model. You know, farmers and gardeners know something profound, which is they depend on plants growing, but they can't make it do, because they can't make it happen. You know, you don't make a plant grow. The plant grows itself. You don't, you know, paint the leaves and stick the roots on. What farmers and gardeners do is create the conditions under which this will happen. We live in LA here, not far from Death Valley. Death Valley is so called because nothing grows there. It's the hottest place in America. Nothing grows because it doesn't rain. In 2004, the winter of 2004, it rained. 7 inches of rain fell on Death Valley. And in the winter of 2005, there was a phenomenon. The whole floor of Death Valley was carpeted with flowers. People came from all over America to see this extraordinary sight they thought they might never see. Death Valley was alive, effectively. What it proved, of course, was Death Valley was never dead. It's dormant. Right beneath the surface are these seeds of possible growth. waiting for the right conditions. And if the conditions come, life inevitably will reappear. When the conditions become harsh again, it sinks beneath the ground, they form husks, and they sit and protect themselves against the hostility that they're confronted with. And I think it's exactly the same way with people. People who work in education know it. If you value children differently, people know it in organizations, if you value the people who work with you differently, if you give them opportunities for creative space to contribute in a way that they feel responsible for, if you change the conditions, it's true in families and communities, people behave differently. They flourish differently. And if the conditions are hostile and harsh, they become self-protective. So I think we need to shift. This whole thing, then, about the element for me is about setting up what the conditions are under which people flourish and the ones that prevent it happening. But I came across a great piece recently from Michelangelo. I mean, it's been around for a while. I just saw it recently. But this just in, you know, from Michelangelo. Here he goes again. Michelangelo wrote a short discourse on the David, you know, the sculpture. And effectively, I'm paraphrasing now High Renaissance Italian, so forgive me. He was saying that I can't take credit for the David. He said, I didn't make the David. I didn't create the David. I revealed it. You know, it was in the stone all the time. It was just there. My job was just to find it and uncover it. And he said, it's an easy thing for a sculptor to do. Because all you have to do is remove the parts of the stone that aren't David. And then David appears in front of you. And I think that's true in a way for our own lives. You know, we become encrusted with all kinds of preconceptions about ourselves, other people's views of ourselves. A sense of authenticity comes when you try to strip some of that stuff away and try to get back to some real sense of who you think you might be through the work that you might do. Michelangelo also said something very interesting. He said, the problem for human beings is not that we aim too high and fail. Much more often, it's that we aim too low and succeed. So what the element is about is to try and reconstitute our sense of possibility and to relate it to the real challenge that we face currently, both culturally and economically. It's based on, I think, a more optimistic view of human potential, of human ability, of intelligence, of creativity, but also that the thing that really starts to make people perform properly in their own lives is when they connect to something that resonates with who they feel they are. And I think that's really the core message of all is that in a very literal sense, finding your passion changes everything. Thank you very much.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for that. That was a fantastic way to set the stage. I really enjoyed the book, by the way. And
thank you, Ray.
Particularly the there were so many great stories. You told a few already about Paul McCartney and Bar Connor. This such an incredible range of experiences that you capture in here. In fact, it's probably the only book I've ever read where if you, I think I just looked to see if you check in the index, the great economist Paul Samuelson is back to back with Vidal Sassoon. So it's probably the only book that has ever done that before. Do you have a favorite story that you really think captures the element, a favorite one of the anecdotes that you use?
No. Yes.
That'll move things along. Thank you.
Actually, I don't know about a favorite one. There are many in the book, but one of them I think is among the many you know, that are interesting is I was talking to a guy who became a friend, Matt, who his great thing, I mean, he didn't have any great passion for going to gymnasiums. But he spent most of his early childhood doodling and loved doing it, just doing cartoons. And he got into trouble at school for it because he kept doodling over all of his books, his textbooks and his essays, had little drawings all over it. And he kept being chastised for it. But he said, it's all I really like doing. And the only time he was really allowed to do it was in the art classes. But he said, even then, you know, they weren't that hot on cartoons. And in fact, he got into trouble with one of his high school art teachers because he was using up so much paper.
Went outside the lines.
Yeah, exactly. He said, I was like doing 30 drawings a lesson. He said, oh, there's another one. And the art teacher was kind of slow down, spend more time. He said, well, I don't need to because, you know, I'm trying to get this stuff out. He found some people at school who also shared his passion, you know, for cartooning. And he said, but for that, I probably would have given up a bit because I needed other people who made me feel it was okay. But he said, I never thought this would lead anywhere. I just knew I loved doing it, and that's all I really wanted to do. My parents didn't encourage it. And he said, and I reckon probably my life was going to be working some... I was no good at school, particularly. He said, I got by, but I didn't enjoy it. He said, but I thought I was going to end up in a tire warehouse somewhere, you know, for the rest of my life, and I'd be doing cartoons in the break. Anyway, he moved to L.A. After going to a liberal arts college and started doing a cartoon strip in a magazine. He was hired to do it. And he really loved doing that. And then he was invited to pitch an idea for an interstitial cartoon strip on a television series. And he said, he went into this, literally said, I said, you're not serious about this, are you? I mean, he went into this meeting with these TV executives and he didn't know what idea he was going to put to them. He said, I hadn't really thought about it. I was in the waiting room thinking, what am I going to do? He said, and as I walked through the door, I sat down, I said, he said, what do you think, Benu? He said, I'd like to do a cartoon strip about a family called The Simpsons. This is Matt Groening. And The Simpsons went from there, of course, to be this global cultural phenomenon that we all know, you know, a kind of global cultural empire. But it was driven by his passion for doodling and his playfulness around it, you know. So the thing about this is that, you know, for some people, you know, it's mathematics. You know, for some people, it's athletics. For some people, it's doodling. For some people, hair. It's physics. Or hair, yeah. I mean, Vidal Sassoon's story is very interesting.
Yeah, it is a great story.
He wanted to be a soccer player, you know, but his mum insisted he trained as a hairdresser. And this was before the war in Britain. And the big breakthrough was he invented the blow dry. It seems like extraordinary, but the blow dry revolutionized women's hairstyling. It meant you could cut hair very differently. You know, he lived in a time when people were, it was all curlers and perms, you know, and he suddenly started, he was very interested and became influenced by modernist sculpture. And he thought, this is a principle we could apply here to our own, you know, to our own personal aesthetic. It's very interesting to see it. In all of their case, it's not they sat out saying, I mean, Matt wasn't at school thinking, one day I'm going to pitch the Simpsons idea. You know, it's how the thing evolves. It's how your environment is shaped by your relationship with it.
One of the things in that regard I wanted to ask you about was how companies can foster the creation of that sort of environment. When you get down to the organizational level, you talk in the book, for instance, about the importance of mentoring.
Yeah.
And you also talk about how some seem to find this sweet spot for success within the group dynamic. I'm thinking of the Traveling Wilburys story, for example.
Yes.
So what can organizations do, what can businesses do to foster an environment for those two things, mentoring and that fantastic group dynamic that works?
Most of the people in the book, not all, but I'd say most of them, can point to somebody else who helped them, you know, a mentor. There's a chapter in the book called Somebody Help Me. And the reason it's there is that very often I find that people take their own abilities for granted. The great enemy, I think, of human progress is common sense, you know, the things we take for granted. And let me just ask you, if I may, it's difficult to know, of course, what you take for granted, because you do take it for granted. So let me ask you something you may take for granted. How many of you here are over the age of 30? I thought so. Everyone under 30 is in bed, you know, but sensibly having a sleep. But let me ask you again, put your hands up if you're wearing a wristwatch. There you go. That's most of us. Me too. Ask a room full of teenagers that question. Now, did you think about that this morning as you were fumbling around, you know, to get ready? Was this an agony of indecision? You know, shall I put the watch on? You know, will I, you know, I don't know, will anybody ask me the time? You know, is it a watchy day? You know, were these the issues racing through your mind as you got ready? I mean, did you think, oh, I'll leave it, I'll come back after I've had some coffee, I can't decide this now? You didn't, you just put it on, because you take it for granted. It's a ritual, it's a routine, it's a habit. You think, I've got to do that, I'll put the watch on. You don't even think about it. Kids don't wear watches. I don't mean they never do. They rarely do. And the reason is that for them, the time is everywhere. They've grown up in a world of digital culture. It's a difference somebody once called between digital natives and digital immigrants. You know, that for them, the time is on their cell phones, it's on their iPods, it's on their laptops. My daughter never wears a watch. She's 19. She can't see the point. She says to me, why would you wear that, a separate thing?
just to tell the time. She said, like, it's a single function device. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how lame is that? You know? Yeah. And I said, no, no, it tells the date as well, you know. The reason I'm just taking on this little thing is I have a big interest in creativity. And this is what organizations need to foster increasingly. When I talk to people about this, I often hear people saying to me, you know, particularly policymakers or sometimes CEOs, they say, excuse me, the problem is you can't define creativity. And I say, no, no, the problem is you can't define it because you haven't thought about it. You can define it, and I'll define it for you. Creativity, I define as the process of having original ideas that have value. The process of having original ideas that have value. Now, the thing is, you can be creative at anything. Anything. Not just the arts or design, you know, but anything. Anything that involves intelligence. But there are conditions. So my point is that there are skills here to be learned. They include reassessing the things about ourselves that we take for granted. I mean, if we take this kind of stuff for granted, what are we taking for granted about our own natural capacities? So in organizations, I have a few principles about this. One of them is that great leaders in organizations have an expansive view of the resources of the organization. Many people are locked into their job descriptions and have all kinds of contributions to make to the organization beyond the job description. I've worked with a couple of companies who have internal universities. There's a great design company in New York I work with, and they run a program of courses and events and symposia every day. It's like being on a campus. People in the company run courses for other people in the company. So, you know, people in finance run courses for the copywriters and vice versa. And they said, actually, we've had two people from finance move across to copywriting because they were so good at it. You know, so they have an internal talent pool. The second is that real innovation comes and creativity comes from collaboration. So I have a chapter in the book called Where's My Tribe? What we find increasingly is that people achieve their best when they connect with other people who share their same sense of passion for this thing. I don't mean they agree with them. You know, in the field of science, there are deep disagreements within different disciplines. Within any field, people disagree sharply, but they value the conversation they're having with other people who validate this interest and who may raise their game. So another great principle, I think, for companies is to encourage great creative teamwork. Now, the thing about this is that great creative teams only flourish in certain circumstances, because we all know that the fate of a bad team is to become a committee. And this is a bad principle. And the third principle is that there are really huge benefits in reviewing the physical environment in which people work. I think of this as the relationship between habits and habitats. You know, the physical environment tells you immediately how you're meant to behave. And if you shift the environment around physically, you begin to shift the habits of behavior in the environment. So redesigning spaces, redesigning institutional habits is the hardest. You can't get a different result if you keep doing the same thing. It's easily said, but it's absolutely true. Make people think differently and different things will come of it.
One of the most interesting parts of the book to me was where you talked about the roadblocks that are thrown up that prevent people, or at least try to prevent people from reaching their element. Some are personal, some are social, some are cultural. When you look around, what do you think is there? What do you think is the biggest obstacle that people encounter?
I don't think I could generalize about which is the biggest for individuals. The whole thing about this is very personal.
Right.
There are certainly those things. A big obstacle to this is personal fear. You know, you think, well, I'll fall on my face, or it's too late. You know, I'm too old for it now. And that's based on an idea, really, that life is a one-way street, which it's not. You know, you can always turn back and do something else and be recursive. But the personal anxiety that you'll make a fool of yourself, or this isn't really something I'm entitled to, is a big factor. A lot of people I've spoken to in the book have said to me, you know, that they've been very lucky. Comes up time and again, this idea of luck. Or people say, well, I would have done, but I didn't have the brakes, you know. Luck is I think, an escape clause here, because, you know, random things happen to everybody. But that's not really what makes a difference. It's not what happens to you.
that makes your life. It's what you make of what happens to you. And there's a lot of pretty hard-edged research around this in psychology. There's a very interesting book which I quote in this. I have a chapter called Do I Feel Lucky? It's a book called The Luck Factor. A psychologist called Gordon Wiseman did a lot of work with people who'd said they were lucky and looked at their attitudes and compared them to people who said they were unlucky. Some very interesting things he did with them. But what it revealed is that people who say they're lucky often have a more expansive view of their environment. They're more willing to take a risk. They're more willing to go out and put themselves, you know, on the edge a bit. They tend to have a different sense of entitlement. They may be nervous, but they're prepared to face it. Whereas people who say they're unlucky and live narrow lives have often not been prepared to push themselves for fear of it not working. So luck, is a big factor, or at least attitude is a factor. And, of course, opportunity is a big factor. And it plays out differently. And the other thing I'd just quickly say for Mike Rick is that often, of course, social factors play into this. You know that. Other people's approval or disapproval. You have to be prepared to confront that. I tell the story in the book. I didn't get to meet him, unfortunately, but I did. I'm fascinated by the story of Paulo Coelho, you know, the author of The Alchemist. Paulo Coelho always wanted to be a writer, but his parents really disapproved of it. I mean, really disapproved of it. They said he should go into law school, and when he persisted with his idea of being a writer, they submitted him to a series of treatments with electroconvulsive therapy. They said he'd gone crazy. And when that didn't work, they committed him to a mental institution. You have to be pretty serious about wanting to be a writer in these situations, you know. But he resisted, and he came out, and he wrote The Alchemist, and, you know, became the person we know him to be. I mean, most of us don't face that kind of treatment, but we do face all kinds of tacit layers of disapproval, you know, and it can just be the raised eyebrow, you know, from a friend or a parent saying, really? What, you? This is why mentoring is so important and why it's not just about looking out for ourselves, but being generous towards other people in their attempts to do this. You know, I mean, Bart Connor's mother might have said to him, Bart, will you stop it with the hands thing? You know, it's a bit embarrassing, to be honest. You know, we bought you shoes. I mean, what's the problem? You know, you know, get on with your homework. You know, a lot of the people in the book, Mick Fleetwood and others, Faith Ringgold, wonderful artist, Terence Tao, the great mathematician, had people around them who saw it and encouraged it rather than stifled and censored it. You know.
So you need, so all those elements are needed: aptitude, passion, and the right conditions, attitude you talk about, and opportunity. And,
yes.
And you say that, in fact, in the book, without the right opportunities, you never know what your aptitudes are or how far they might take you.
Correct, yeah.
You don't spend a lot of time in the book, though, talking about opportunity. And I began thinking about this in the context of those in communities where there really isn't opportunity, or there's at least a decided disadvantage in opportunity. So, you know, I was thinking, you know, communities, many in LA, where people are really just scraping to get by, having a tough time, maybe out of work, you know, Compton with 15% unemployment, other, you know, communities where it's just so hard to make it. In that way, where there may be a lack of opportunity, is the element become kind of a luxury of the well-to-do?
No, I really don't think so. I
okay.
mean, the opportunity is very important. I mean, you can see it very starkly in some obvious ways. I mean, you know, there aren't that many pearl divers in the Sahara. You know, the, you know what I mean? Rodeos aren't a big news in the Antarctic. You know, there have to be certain conditions in place. But the book is full of stories of people who actually did kind of go on a march, you know, people from pretty bad backgrounds who nonetheless had to go out and create some new opportunity for themselves. And I think this is a big challenge for our institutional processes. You know, when you come to plan educational systems or social welfare systems, you know, or community support systems, understanding what the conditions are that you're trying to create. You know, there are lots and lots of examples of bad neighborhoods that have been turned around, of communities that have come together around certain sorts of principles. And that's really what I'm trying to sort out here, is not to say that there's a one-size-fits-all. On the contrary, but understanding that things change if the conditions alter, and they include the physical environment. You know, they include, obviously, work opportunities. If you look at Bogota, I don't mention this in the book, but there was a mayor in Bogota, he did it, I think, a three-year term, who totally transformed that city in 2 to 3 years by changing the physical environment, of marginalizing traffic through some of the poorer areas, refusing to build freeways and instead investing in parklands. And Bogota had the highest crime rate in South America,
which is a pretty staggering crime rate. You know, really, that's against some pretty stiff competition in South America. And the crime rates have been, during that process, drastically reduced because of the shift in the physical environment. You know, I'm from Liverpool, and I still bear a grudge, honestly, against the city planners of the 1960s, who took a wonderful Victorian city, carved it out, eviscerated it, and built these high-rise apartments, not even apartments, on the outskirts of town, you know, with no social amenities, created a problem in the gang cultures, and then vilified the people who were experiencing it. You know, I mean, this is not, as they say, brain science. You know, people are people and need certain circumstances in which to work. And the problem, I think, is that we have often approaches to city planning which are based on utility and mechanism, you know, on traffic flows and, you know, and things of that sort. I mean, obviously you need basic things, but if you look at the way communities have traditionally grown before we started to plan them, they are much more like organisms. You know, they have interrelated services and opportunities. And part of it is that we've segmented these things out. We have specialized our communities into separate functions, and they have become dysfunctional.
Right. Yeah. Now mixed use is coming back. So we all
absolutely. Right. Absolutely. A great friend of mine in New York is Ron Pompey. Is working on a number of plans. He calls them C3 communities. It's right. Culture, commerce, and community. It's really important that we should think that way. Schools have become factories. They're separated out from the community, you know, and our children were sent off to these things to be processed. And I think this is quite literally the case. I don't blame teachers, by the way. I'm a great admirer of teachers and educators. They did a very hard job in very difficult circumstances, you know. And, you know, schools get blamed for these things, you know, but schools don't invent these social problems. It's just where they turn up. You know, kids only spend part of their time at school, and they bring all this stuff with them.
I want to ask one more question, then open it up to you. And while we're on education, you make a very compelling case, and did so this morning, about the need not just to reform education, but to transform education. And you talk about several specific ways to do this, including eliminating what you call the hierarchy of subjects, so that, you know, math is not more important than the arts or and so forth. But another key, you say, is to make the curriculum personalized.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you go about doing that, say, here in Los Angeles, where LAUSD has classrooms of 30 or more kids and is now facing funding cutbacks, where those class sizes may get bigger before they get smaller.
Well, I believe this fundamentally. The challenge for education is not to reform it, but to transform it. You know, we have an antiquated system ideologically as well as economically. You know, it's rooted in the 19th century, into 19th century industrialism. We're still preparing people for manufacturing jobs, you know, and I don't mean that manufacturing is going to disappear anytime soon, but the whole equation has shifted. This is why, you know, when I was a kid, if you went to college and got a degree, you were guaranteed a job, because very few people had degrees, comparatively, like 10% of the population, probably. So a college degree was like Willy Wonka's golden ticket, you know, and now it's like the wrapper, you know. So I think this idea of personalizing, and I'll just explain if I may very briefly. There are several moving parts, you know, interrelated processes in education, if you're interested in education as a conversation. One of them is the curriculum, which is what it is we're meant, you know, we intend people to learn. The curriculum, to me, has to be totally refashioned. And I don't mean this whimsically. I can explain, if we had more time, what it might look like. But it means challenging some of the things you take for granted. One of them is the hierarchy. You know, this belief that art, you know, science and technology and math will deliver the future to us unassisted. This is nonsense. You know, one of the most fertile periods in human history was the Renaissance. The Medicis, you know, were great patrons of the Renaissance, and they helped to create one of the most creative communities in the history of humanity. But they didn't do it with a math strategy. You know, it wasn't like, if we just figure maths out here and get some standardized tests, well, it's a home run. The truth is that communities depend upon a diversity of talent. And, you know, the Renaissance didn't make these distinctions between arts and sciences that we make now. That's a recent innovation. But even the language is important. You see, since start people saying, well, you know, we have to have a hierarchy of subjects, or do we need different subjects? I don't even want to talk about subjects. I think subjects are a very bad idea. You know, because it suggests that things are all defined by their content. Chemistry isn't a subject. Literature is not a subject, as defined by subject matter. I mean, any chemist will tell you that chemistry is an interrelated set of disciplines which have certain concepts, certain ways of thinking, certain modes of analysis, and certain areas of exploration and focus. And it interrelates, you know, with physics and aesthetics and all kinds of other things. But we've built our systems on this idea that there are separate subjects. And then we get into these debates about which are the more important. So the whole starting point is wrong from my point of view. I much prefer the idea of disciplines as a basis for education, and it opens up immediately the idea of interdisciplinarity. You know, we end up thinking arts and sciences are totally different. They're not. There's a huge amount of objectivity and discipline in arts practice and a huge amount of aesthetics in science. So the curriculum is one big piece of it. What governments traditionally do is say, oh, we've got to start nailing down the content. And you know, they start having panic attacks about it and start to standardize the curriculum. I think we should have broad frameworks, but leave it to the school to have more discretion. The second thing they latch onto is assessment. And typically, they impose a regime of standardizing. Now, standardizing can be really important. You know, if I have a medical exam, I want some standardized tests. I do, honestly. You know, I mean, I want to know what my cholesterol level is compared to everybody else's. I don't want my doctor to measure it on some personal scale he invented in the car. You know what I mean? I don't say your cholesterol is what I call level orange. You know, what? You know, tell me, doc, I can take it. Standardized tests are useful for diagnostic purposes. The problem is they have become the purpose of education now in this country rather than a means of raising standards. And we've come to confuse raising standards with standardizing. So we need to look very differently at the assessment processes. But the third thing about this, Rick, is that in my experience, the only thing, and I've looked at lots of education systems around the world, I've worked in education for a long time, some of you work in it, some of you you've all been through it, you know for a fact that the only thing ever that improves education ever is the quality of teaching. It doesn't matter how good your curriculum is, it doesn't matter what your standards are, if you have demoralized or underqualified or inexpert teachers, you'll never make it. The only thing that improves a school is great teaching. And there isn't a school in the country, and there are many great schools, there are very few schools, actually no schools, that are greater than the teachers in it. Because it's the teachers that help to raise the quality of learning, the quality of commitment. We know it in every other field. If we look at great orchestras, we look at the conductors and the instrumentalists. And we value great orchestras not because they're all the same or standardized, but because they're all different and they exceed the standards. It's true of restaurants. It's true of every other field of work, great companies. And yet, we've sold ourselves this idea in education that we all have to standardize and homogenize everything. And personalizing education is inescapably important. You know, in the end, the quality of education is about individual achievement within a community. Every child matters in education. You know, they're not components in a process. We're talking about human minds here, you know, and kids have to be energized. You know, I can't imagine, the state gets obsessed with reading standards and national league tables, and they say, oh, we've got to beat the drum. I can't imagine there's a kid in L.A. that gets out of bed in the morning thinking, what can I do to raise the state's reading standards? You know, how can I help? You know,
they're too busy trying to find their watch.
Yeah, I'm available. That, yeah, what time is it? Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Wait, let me open it up to you all. Yes, sir.
What's your story? How did you find your passion, and how do you describe it?
It's in the book. Buy this book.
I've got the book.
Well, I know we haven't got much time, but briefly, I mean, my wife encouraged me to tell my story in the book, because you know, like, you know, you take your own stuff for granted. But I was born in Liverpool in 1950, and this is relevant. If I hadn't been born, for example, you know, I wouldn't be here, would I? So it's very relevant. And we live right next door to one of the major soccer grounds in Liverpool. It's football, we call it. And I'm from a big family. I'm one of seven kids. And you know, the great expectation there always was that one of your, of the fathers, was one of your sons would play in the local football team. My dad used to be a semi-professional footballer. Until I was four, it was all looking good. You know, I mean, I was very strong, very fit. My dad used to take me to the park. We used to play. I can't remember any of this. You know, I was four. But he said of all the boys in the family, I was the natural football player. And that's where it was going to go. And then, you may recall this, in 1954, there were these great polio epidemics. So I got polio at the age of four. The only one in the family, interestingly, despite my attempts to cross-infect everybody, you know, they... drink this, you know. So I was kind of let off and quarantined. I was in hospital for nearly a year. And for the first couple of months, I was totally paralyzed, and then it started to come back. So I got some function back in my left leg and none in my right. And I have to say, by the way, I came out of hospital when I was five on two braces with crutches and a wheelchair, blonde curly hair and a lisp. I was unbearably cute. Insufferably cute. People came up on the street and forced money into my hands, you know. Which one of my brothers promptly forced out of it and kept himself. But so that kind of put paid to my soccer career. My chance of making the team at the time reduced considerably. Not so much now, given the way they're performing. I think I might get a chance. But my dad and my mum were just very smart about it. You know, they, as this went on, they made it pretty clear that the only way I would ever get on, you know, would not be through manual work, but through getting educated. And so they put more pressure on me than the rest of the family to make sure I got a proper education. And I actually went to, from five to till I was 10, 11, I went to a special school, a school for kids with, you know, for the physically handicapped. And I wouldn't be here now, truthfully. I mean, actually, if I hadn't got polio, I'd probably now be running a sports bar in Manhattan, you know, with my medals on the wall and boring people about my glory days of 1960s football squads, hopefully. But I was kind of pottering along in this school, you know, and I do tell a story in the book about it. This guy came in one day who I didn't know, he was just another visitor. We used to get a lot of them. I mean, I was in a classroom, you see, with kids with hydrocephalus. One of my best friends, Robert, had hydrocephalus, who's, you know, enlarged skull. There were kids with cerebral palsy. It was very hard to hear them, to understand them. We could work out what people were saying. There were kids with polio, asthma, heart disease, epilepsy, you know, in my class. I was saying recently, my classroom was like the barroom scene from Star Wars, you know, it was... But we all got on, you know. The thing is, if you're in these communities, you're not looking at other people's disabilities. I mean, you're looking at who they are. It's just like any other place. I probably had a better time in my school than my brothers did in their school. You know, what attracts you are like, are these interesting, funny people or not? You know, I don't care what your condition is. Do I want to hang out with you? So we're just getting on. You tend to take all that stuff for granted. Then this guy came in one day, and he came and chatted to me. And the next day, or shortly afterwards, I was called out to the head teacher's office. And this man was sitting there too, and we chatted a bit. And then a little while later, I was called again, and I met this guy who was a psychologist, I gather, you know, and he asked me a whole series of questions, which I now know to be an IQ test. So I did this thing, and then I was moved up several classes. We had a public examination system in Britain at the time called the 11 Plus. And if you took this exam and got a certain level on it, you went through to the, we call them grammar schools. They're kind of high-tier schools. And so I met this amazing teacher. And this man was Charles Strafford, I found out later on. He became a great friend of the family. And I met, I was put in the hands of this teacher, Miss York, who was just fantastic. A real tartar, you know. She wasn't messing around. And she had taken on the job of making sure I was ready for the 11 plus. So I took it. I did past papers and I sat at the front of the class and wrote essays for it. I don't know how long it all went on, I can't remember. But I became, the school merged a year or two later, but I became the only person in the history of the school to pass the 11 plus. I think others have passed it since, but I was the first. And I went into the public school system, to this grammar school, and that was my beginning, really. I had it off. So Charles Strafford became a great mentor to me and to the family. And I often think, what would have happened if he hadn't come in? And what he said was, apparently he told me later on, he got chatting and he went and saw the head teacher and he said, and spoke to the teacher, he said, well, what's he doing? And he said, I was just kind of pottering around at the back of the class, you know, and he figured I had something that wasn't probably being developed, you know, I was... So it was that, really. And then I got involved in education subsequently. And I suppose thinking back, I mean, I don't want to psychologize this too much. I've only really thought about it recently. But I suppose somewhere in me, there's always been this sense of people being underestimated. You know, that I was with kids who were very smart, I felt, and funny in the school for the physically handicapped, who were being given probably a supportive pastoral education, but there were no expectations about what they might do. I mean, Miss York was different. No, she was like Miss Brodie. She wasn't having it, you know. And so I think that's just it, really. I guess that's kind of where it originates. But I've always felt strongly about it.
It's interesting. We were talking backstage about it really plays to Peter Drucker's idea that people spend way too much time focused on weakness, their weaknesses and others' weaknesses, and not on the strengths that
Absolutely.
We all have, and maximizing strengths and eliminating the weakness by doing so.
Completely, yeah.
Who else? In the middle there?
Thank you so much. You're so entertaining. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
I went to a rally here in Los Angeles a couple of months ago. Well, probably a couple of months ago. It was after Proposition 8 was passed. And this rally couldn't take place downtown where there was a setting where everybody could gather. We wanted to make, you know, protest... this passage of this particular thing. And excuse me, I'm a little nervous. And there was no great lawn to all collect ourselves. Mm-hmm. The transportation, everybody couldn't get there. Mm-hmm. There's no, they shut down the transportation, I don't know if you're familiar with that, years ago.
Yes.
Goodyear bought out the, you know, the tire company bought out the...
Is that true, by
yes,
the way?
Yes, apparently. That's what I heard.
I was having a conversation about it last night about how that happened and what the commercial interests were. They shut the transport
system. They shut it down so everybody could have cars. So essentially, you know, all the... I live in Echo Park now, and there used to be a lovely little streetcar that ran from downtown right into Echo Park. And, you know, so... And we're having a horrible time just getting trains to the airport. My partner was complaining, you know, all this traffic. Why couldn't I just take a train from downtown to the airport? Well, we don't have that. You know, so it's abysmal. And the whole idea of having a, you know, a beautiful grand park like they do Millennium Park in Chicago or in New York, Central Park, that wasn't planned here. And I feel like Los Angeles is left out as a community where everybody can gather, all the diversity of this beautiful city, can all arrive in one place and have this great sprawling lawn to, you know, react in. Everybody, you know, can share. Yeah. And unfortunately... and now that you live here, it would be great to have, you know, someone who understands how wonderful the diversity is and how we can help this community establish something like that. So I'm trying to look for people who will help me get that vision happening. There is a Grand Avenue complex being done, but they didn't put any great park into it. It's, you know, smashed into streets and, you know, not really adjacent to anything. But in any case, that was my comment.
Yes, thank you very much.
And thank you, and very enlightening.
Thank you. I have a lawn at home. you can come and hang out. But, you know, seriously, I was in Philadelphia 10 days ago. You know, they have an enormous parkland area right in the heart of the city, which, you know, makes Central Park look like a postage stamp. And that was planned in. It's a kind of woodland and forested area. It's a fantastic refuge for people and a great place of renewal. Central Park is like that. I mean, from Liverpool, interestingly, has more open parkland than any other city in Europe. But where I live on the west side, there have been pitched battles about the use of the Veterans Park. You know, people wanting to turn that into commercial leasing property. And the local people are hanging on saying, listen, we need somewhere to breathe here. I mean, a lot of the great creative energy of humanity comes from cities. The price we pay is that people become detached from nature. You know, I mean, you know that. There are lots of kids in Los Angeles, you know, particularly in the east side, who've never been to the beach, never seen the ocean, you know, who've no idea where their food comes from. They have just no idea. They live in this rather bleak urban landscape. And it's not surprising that people have their sensibilities brutalized by it. I think it's really, really important that we think hard about these environmental changes, and if they can do it in Bogota, quite seriously, you know. There's a great series actually on PBS about some of these issues, about redesigning the urban landscape. And I think, you know, it's not just about sorting out the schools, it's the environment in which they work too. Yeah, I think it's a very good point, thank you.
Great. Let's do one or two more, and if I can ask you to keep your questions brief, that would be great. Yes, let's do here, and then we'll come there.
Thank you.
There.
Thank you. Thank you for your speech. You mentioned that the source of the human issue, or the environment as well as the human resources issue, is a source of the industrialization being the source of it. I was wondering that the need for a creative resource, or if someone would like to do things which they love, there needs to be a demand.
There needs to be a demand for
that. So the I guess the deterioration of the human resources, I'm thinking, is an equation of the required demand created by the industrialization. How do you foresee that source to be improved? The demand which is created by the industrialization need, which requires machines rather than people who think.
Well, just a couple of quick comments. One is that I'm not sure about this demand issue, honestly, in several ways. I mean, great creative people come along when there was no demand for them, you know. And nobody was waiting for Martha Graham to turn up. You know, there's no demand for her. But once she turned up, she created a whole new world for people. Nobody's waiting for, you know, for Charlie Mingus, you know, but when he turned up, nobody's waiting for the theory of relativity. But when it turned up. So people have a way of creating a demand around the things they do, particularly if what they do is innovative and interesting. But the other thing is that what I'm talking about isn't necessarily something people have to do for their living. Some people do. So, you know, some people are passionate about something that they're good at that also makes them a really good living. But some people choose not to do the thing they love for their work because in a way that changes the relationship with it. There's a chapter in the book called For Love or Money. And a whole series of stories there about people who are doing something they absolutely love to do alongside the thing they do to earn their money. You know, we all have our own needs about money and, you know, our own responsibilities. But I think if we've learned anything, particularly over the last few months, about money, is it's no guarantee of well-being and fulfillment, no matter how much of it you have. You need enough. But you also need other things in your life that give you balance and a sensibility and a sense of purpose. So there's a whole section in the book on amateurs. And amateurs, I think, have to be taken very seriously. You know, in our culture, which has become over-specialized and over-professionalized in many respects, we tend to think that an amateur is not only non-professional, but it kind of suggests being unprofessional. Now, there's some areas in which you definitely want a professional. You know, I was saying this recently. If you're having some piece of surgery done to you, you don't really want somebody who does it part-time tinkering around with you. You know what I mean? You know, but an amateur in the proper sense of the term isn't only non-professional. An amateur in the strict sense is somebody who does it for the love of it. You know, it's from amour. You know, it's for the love of this thing. And many people do things for the love of it at a very high level indeed. Not just in the arts, but in the sciences. I have stories in the book about archaeologists, about, you know, astrophysicists, who do this apart from the job that earns them a living. So I think getting that relationship right, it's in the end, it's about balance and synergy. And I think what tends to happen in people's lives, if they find something they love to do that they flourish in, it lifts their game overall. Like you find this in schools. I'm not suggesting that in schools, you know, kids should only do the thing they want to do. We all have to do things we don't much like doing, and we have to struggle with things and get the hang of it. But if your experience only is of struggle and of not feeling connected to the thing you're doing, you eventually, your energy starts to sap. You need somewhere in your life where you think, actually, I get this too, and I can do this, and this is where I really start to flourish. And it's why, for example, under No Child Left Behind, the scything away of arts programs has been such a disaster for public education, because many kids only really come to life in these programs that have been cut away. And even, you know, the kids who succeed in other areas still benefit from them. You know, it's based on, I think, a despairing conception of how people think.
That's great. Let's do one last quick one, and then we'll continue the conversation, I take it, when you're signing books. Would that be?
Yes, if
great.
But only if you have actually bought the book.
There you go.
I'm
not signing brochures.
Dr. Robinson.
Leaflets, personal account.
Would you share your thoughts with the difference between those who share manipulate ideas as opposed to people that manipulate people?
Explain what you mean by that.
I have a feeling that creativity is something that is with folks that manipulate ideas as opposed to people that manipulate people.
I'm not sure I agree with you on that, if I understand you properly. Creativity to me is a function of intelligence. And have you got an extra 2 minutes? Can I just show you some pictures? Can I? Are these slides still here? Oh. By the way, just out of interest, there is a website that we've set up for the book called theelementbook.com. We have a blog there, so I'd really encourage you if you know, to get involved, because we're trying to build a community around all this stuff as well. Pardon? I've got a couple of Bob Dylan DVDs. Do you want those? Yes. Yeah, actually, and also there's an audio version of the book. But, yeah, but we're doing something. Let me just... just go back. I kind of summarise the element here. It's kind of four things. One is actually, like, I get it. This is Bart Connor getting it, you know, really. The second is, you know, that I love it. There's a great story about Eva Lawrence, and I encourage you to read this story. It's a wonderful, one of the world's top female pool players. It's a fascinating story. There's a chapter called In the Zone, you know, where you know you're doing something you love to when time just goes into a different space completely. It's about wanting it. This is Faith Ringgold, the great artist, who always, from the age of, as a girl, wanted to be an artist against considerable odds. And then this is Don Lipsky, who had to really confront his family to become one of the country's top installation artists and sculptors. But the thing I just want to show, forget all this stuff. Oh, sorry, that's Death Valley. Isn't that great? In 2005. But this is what I want to show you. Just have a quick read that. This is about your point about creativity. I love this quotation. It's from Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher. It seems to me to absolutely encapsulate the core question of Western philosophy. You know, is life pointless and meaningless and random and accidental? And should we not worry about it? Or is it as full of purpose and possibility as Hamlet thought it was? Forgive the male language here, by the way. I mean, he wrote this in the 1950s when he didn't know he couldn't, you know, so I don't... I don't want to edit him posthumously. It doesn't seem fair. But I got very interested in this first bit, you know, about the small and unimportant planet. And, you know, we all know the planet is small. But how small exactly? You see, the problem is, you get images like this. This is from the Hubble telescope. You know, distance in space is measured in light years, which is the distance light travels in a year. This is an area of 170,000 light years. So what are you going to do with that as a piece of information? You know, go, wow, yeah, huge, I have no doubt. See, where is the Earth in that? How big is the Earth, or small, relatively? The problem with seeing how small or large the Earth is the distances involved, you know, distort the sense of perspective. So what? So I came across these images on the internet where somebody, I think, had the brilliant idea of taking the Earth out of the sky and landing it upon the floor with some other planets for comparison. Just for size, so it's like a team photo, you know, of the solar system. So this is the first one. Isn't that fantastic? You see, there are a couple of things I always want to say about this. The first is that, well, you know, I think we're looking groovy here, don't you? And I also think we're less worried than we were about being invaded by Martian hordes. You know, I mean, don't you? I mean, like, bring it on. You know, I feel. And also, Pluto is no longer a planet. And we can see why now, frankly. Really, it's, but keep your eye on the Earth as we pull back and bring some other planets in. You see, and it's all a bit less encouraging now, isn't it, when we get Jupiter in? And Pluto has become a kind of cosmic embarrassment at this point. But we know the Sun is a very big deal. How big, though? Do you know, relatively, to the size of the Earth? Is it like twice the size of Jupiter? Just keep your eye on this when we bring the Sun in. I checked these images with NASA, and they said, yes, this is about right as proportion. Keep your eye on the Earth when we bring the Sun in. Did you know that? That's amazing, isn't it? One question I think it's worth pondering on, talking about the crisis in the world's natural environment, how come we can't get all the energy we need from that for that? You know, I mean, look at it. You know, really, Edison said this, all the energy we need is up there, and instead we're burning the ground beneath our feet and choking ourselves to death. You know, it's insane that we should be doing this. But we know the Sun is a big deal, but keep your eye on the Sun as you come back a bit more. That's against Arcturus. You know, the Earth is now invisible. But keep your eye on Arcturus, because the Sun is now Pluto in this picture. And keep going back. Arcturus has now become Pluto, and the Sun has disappeared on the scale. And these are just some nearby objects in our end, you know, of the cosmos. So when you go back here, the Earth is inconceivably, pitifully tiny on the cosmic scale. So I just want to make a couple of quick comments about it. The first is, whatever you woke up worrying about this morning, you know, get over it. Get an angle on this. You know, make the call and apologize and move on. But the second thing is that we may be tiny in cosmic terms, but we are nonetheless the species that did produce Hamlet and the Sistine Chapel, you know, and the great religions and quantum mechanics and quantum physics and the great musical traditions of humanity and 6,000 languages and the great philosophies. And we owe it, I think, to the thing you're pointing to, which is this extraordinary, I think, unique power that human beings have of imagination, the ability to bring into mind things that aren't present to our senses. Now, I'm not saying other species don't have it, but we have no idea the extent to which they may have it. And they show no evidence of it in anything like the same degree that we do. You know, I mean, you do not see other species in forest clearings agonizing over these images, you know, going, oh, my God, I had no idea, you know. Other species seem to sing, but they don't compose operas. You know, they seem to communicate, but they don't write novels. You know, they look anxious, you know, but they're not sitting down with a glass of Jack Daniels listening to Miles Davis, you know. We have this unique power to conceive of alternatives and possibilities and to create things as a consequence. And this is really important to me, to come to your point, that I don't want to make distinctions between thinkers and doers. I want to recognize that the process of creativity and of creation is the fundamental capacity of humanity. And if we know anything, it's about how these things interconnect. And the good news for me is if we've made things, we can remake them. We have created the problem for this planet just now. We have. You know, this isn't the other species. You know, this isn't the butterflies that got us into this mess. You know, it's not the wildebeest that have taken us off track. This is us. And we have an opportunity now, if we think more expansively about our possibilities and get a sense of perspective on ourselves, to remake things differently. But it means a shift in consciousness. And it's the great sense of optimism I took out of this inauguration, that we have people here now, particularly in Obama, who seems to have a genuinely global view of things, a genuine sense that this is a time to try and remake things, but that we have to do it. And not wait for anybody else to do it. And I think it starts with our own lives and the influence we can have. And the truth is, you never know the extent of your own influence. You know, but you can choose to have it or not. And having some faith in your own creativity, I think, is the place to really begin.
On that hopeful note, let's thank Sir Ken.
Thank you very much. Sir Ken Robinson will be in the lobby signing his books. Be sure to take your Drucker Centennial Anniversary swag as you leave. Our next forum is on February 24th, featuring Mohamed El Arian, the CEO of PIMCO.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.